Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir.
My guest must be here.
General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
No, it's okay, it really is. Oh, welcome once again to Madame Perry's Salon. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I am just so psyched. Out of all the let's say, less than a pleasing things that have been happening this fall or since last month. Some of the good things are that I have been having the most fantastic guests, and you've been letting me know by your comments, by sharing, by listening, by the downloads. I am just so grateful. And this has been a fun week. We had Monday night, we had Frank DeVille Greenville, who's a producer, guitarist, songwriter, and he was here. He's on the tour with the Gap Band right now. I talked about his work with Usher, Timbaland, I am so unhip, Beyonce, and all sorts of folks. And then last night we had Heather Ash Amara teaching us about the warrior goddess and claiming the destiny of and the woman that we were meant to be. And tonight, one more exciting guest. This is somebody I've wanted on the show for a very long time. And he is author, sociologist, Dr. Randy Blazak. Now, let me tell you, a lot of people know who Randy Blazak is. He is, as I said, a sociologist. He was formerly, professor at Portland, Oregon, University of Portland, I believe it is. And he's the director of the Hate Crime Research Network and the co-founder of Oregon Spotlight, which monitors hate groups in Oregon. And he's the chair of the Oregon Coalition Against Hate Crimes. And like I said, I've been wanting guy on the show for a long time. So why don't we open the beaded curtain here and welcome Randy Blazak to Madame Perry's Salon.
Well, what an honor to be here. I'm very excited.
So am I. Come on in, this is a nice cushion.
Let me just update a little bit of that because I've bounced around a lot in the academic world. So I just finished up 20 years at Portland State, not at the University of Portland, which is also a great university.
Sorry.
Both two great universities here in Portland. As an academic, our university affiliations are important to us. I'm on the faculty now at the University of Oregon, so it's easy to get all these Oregons and Portlands mixed up, but I still have my little professor hat on, which is a little bit tilted these days.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm so sorry about the mix-up. You know, I must have had a premonition of that. Today, have you ever listened to John Fugelsang on Sirius XM?
Yeah, sure. We follow each other.
Okay, let's figure that. So today he was introducing a guy. What's his name? Ayers. He was Tom with Harry Chapin, co-founded the Why Hunger Foundation,
wow,
of Hungerthons, and John Fugelsang started off doing this impressive biography of him. And then he said, well, actually, none of that's true. He starts laughing. None of that's true. He says, what? None of that's true. You got another Ayers bio. That's not my bio.
Wow.
And I thought, I love John Fugelsang. I thought, God bless him. He, you know, it happens in the big time. And he covered it beautifully, as I would have expected. And his guest was very gracious, as were you just now. So that's good. But I am so thrilled to have you here. We know some of the same cool people.
We do. I mean, yeah. I was thinking on your last show, you were playing some Ray D'Africo, and Ray and I go back to 1983 when we were tender 19-year-olds roaming the streets of Atlanta.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, those are the days.
1983. Oh, I'll bet. Yes. And I see, and as you know, I'm sure you noticed the inside of Madame Perry's salon is a lot like, as you may have heard, the inside of Jeannie's bottle. So find some nice cushions. I see you brought along one of your trusted advisors, so I hope she'll be comfortable here too.
Yes.
Your advisor, Cozy. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, she's here. She's currently drawing with crayons, hopefully just on her paper and not on the walls by the time we're done.
It's no problem. You know, it's a good place. It's a safe, we call this a safe place. But we're here tonight, or you're here tonight, to talk about your newest novel, your new novel, The Dream Police. And,
yes.
Yeah. So.
Well, let me just say, because it may not follow from, you know, all the academic stuff, is as an academic and, you know, as a tenured professor, there's sort of this publisher-parish climate, which is great. I mean, you love to get published. But what I was publishing was my academic work, which is, I think, as people might figure out, about hate groups and hate crimes. And that's been the main area of my research. But, you know, I came up kind of in the music scene, in the music world. So I had a desire to have a creative outlet. So when I was in Atlanta, I was sort of a poet at large. I hosted some really great poetry readings and worked on the spoken word part of the 1994 Lollapalooza tour and did a lot of that stuff. So, you know, on one side, I'm working on all the sort of heavy academic research, but on the other side, you know, I want to write. And so I've been writing fiction a lot lately, which is sort of a nice way to sort of cleanse myself of some of the heavy academic stuff I've had to write over the years. And yeah, so I have a new novel out, which is pretty cool. And I think we're going to talk about it tonight.
I think we are. It's called The Dream Police. But now I understand The Dream Police is a new novel, but I see you bring back characters from a previous novel that a lot of people love. It's called The Mission of the Sacred Heart. It's the same character 50 years later.
That
so
came out.
Go
ahead, ask your question, because as a professor, I just start talking and then I won't stop. So let's have a more formal interview. You ask me a question and I'll answer without trampling all over.
I think you were going to say what I was going to. The same thing I was thinking of say is that let you kind of recap that and the characters for us.
Yeah. Well, both are set in Portland. I mean, Portland, I don't know what people know about Portland. When I lived in Atlanta, even in the early 90s, there was a sense that Portland was kind of a hotbed of creative energy and a lot of cool bands and writers and, like, the guy that wrote Fight Club and, you know, all this sort of great stuff that was coming out of Portland. And so it's all true. Everything you've heard about Portland is true. Everybody is some type of artistic genius. They're either, like, the greatest songwriter. Well, I mean, I'm kidding because there's a lot of layabouts, but there is, there's sort of something in the air here. So the first book was about these characters. I never know quite how to talk about it, who are sort of in the, what we might now call the music scene or maybe derogatorily the hipster scene, which is certainly another topic of both of these books. One guy is a graduate student. His friend is in the rock band. This guy in the rock band's girlfriend is an opera singer. And then there's a guy that shows up that may or may not be from another planet. I still don't really know. I just reread it recently for the second edition. And I'm like, I don't really know if he's from another planet or not. But the theme of that book, it seems to be, and, you know, this is always a topic that writers talk about, you know, what inspires on the right. It seems to be when I'm going through some drama, some wall of, you know, problems, writing becomes sort of a salvation. So the theme of the first book, in which these characters all sort of exist in Portland, is the issue of suicide and why, and kind of why it's actually hard to kill yourself. I mean, most suicide attempts aren't successful, fortunately. So what is it about that makes us hang on even when we're completely depressed? And when I was writing it, I was one of those people who was completely depressed, and I was loaded up on about 100 milligrams of Zoloft a day, which people might know is an antidepressant. And it's also an antidepressant that keeps you very active. So I wrote an academic book that came out in 2001 while I was on it called Teenage Renegades, Suburban Outlaws, which has done very well. I bought a house. I did all kinds of things because it's sort of like, you know, having a triple espresso shot every couple hours, which always made me think, if my health insurance covers the Zoloft, why doesn't it cover the Starbucks? I never could quite figure that out. But so, you know, I was writing furiously and I was sort of going out and living my life and then coming home and sitting in front of the computer and writing and writing and writing. And so this came out of that. And I wrote it at the beginning, not knowing what the answer was about why you shouldn't kill yourself. And by the time I got to the end of the book, I had the answer. And one of the greatest things about this book, and it did pretty well for a self-published book, I have to say, it's in Hollywood and it's got this sort of a life of its own. But I had one person who was a vet who told me that she was suicidal. She was reading the book and there had been numerous nights where she sat on her bed with a handgun thinking about taking her life. She was reading The Mission of the Sacred Heart and she got to the end and she figured out it was worth it to stick around. And so whatever happens, however many it ends up selling, I feel that the fact that it impacted one person that way, it's a total success. You know, it could never sell another copy. You know, that alone to me was the most powerful praise.
Yeah.
Because that's what I was trying to figure out while I was writing it, because I was sort of in a similar situation as she was. So that's that book. That's that book in a sort of short version. The other part of it is this rock novel thing that we can get into, but the way that it's sort of organized. So the second book, like, do you want to ask a question or should I just keep going?
No, actually, I'll tell you what, giving me a pause here because I don't want to sound like that didn't affect me. It did. I'm just a little speechless, and that's a very sobering thought or staggered thought to think that something you – did you – I just can't imagine how you felt knowing that something you wrote, it's good, I know, but to know that something that you wrote – save someone's life, really.
Yeah,
and quite literally.
It's so humbling. It's so humbling to think that just, you know, sitting and putting words onto a blank page could affect someone. I mean, I know that there have been books that affected me that way, that sort of changed the way I think about the world and or about myself. So I know it can happen. But I'm just very humbled by that. And that's sort of why I'm a little bit of an advocate for this book, and I wanted to have another life because I know there are a lot of people that are in that situation besides her and I, and if it can help other people, and I don't know how many people have been in that situation and read the book. I mean, it's sort of hard to tell with book sales now because the way books work is people read them on their phones or they buy them and then they give them to their friends, and you know, so you don't really know who reads this. It's like when I was reading a poem at a poetry reading, I know who was hearing it. It was the 20 people who were sitting in front of me. But when I put a book out, you don't really know. So I'm hoping that this book will have another life. It's been optioned for a screenplay in Hollywood. A really talented screenwriter has it right now. There's a director who's reading it who hopefully will want to do something with it. And so we're hopeful. We're hopeful. I've learned a lot about the Hollywood thing over the last few years, which is don't get too excited because everything takes a long time and, you know, you never know where we're going to go. Because when I signed the deal, I was like picking out my outfit for the red carpet for the premiere. You know, because we're having meetings about casting, who's going to play this part, who's going to play this part. So I was just ready to, you know, hop in that limo. But I'm just going to let it take its course.
Well, you know, this is rather exciting, and I tell you, I've had on this here in Madame Perry's Salon, and this has been in the last few weeks. I've had one author, Jennifer Irwin. We were talking about her book, but her book is not even published yet, and it's already so the option for a film. It's casting Bradley Cooper. They've already got the director.
Wow.
And I may have to hook you up with her because she said, you know, thankfully, she said yes, it's wonderful to have this happen. It's fantastic. It's a blessing. But my boyfriend is an attorney, so he negotiated my contract. you know, because people don't think about it. You're aware of this, but a lot of people don't realize there's so many little things to be negotiated too, even after, you know, after Mission of Sacred Heart becomes a film. Things like, okay, are you going to be invited? Where are you going to sit during the premiere? Will you be on the red carpet? How big will your name be on the posters?
Yeah.
You know, percentage wise as compared to the rest. There's so many deals. So, we'll just have to get you. Good lawyer.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, it happens in many different ways. I mean, there's just so many different Hollywood stories, and of course, those people who are just, you know, the Hollywood machine is waiting for them to start on a project because they've already got it all cast. I'm coming from the other direction as a sort of a, you know, I'm known. I mean, it's funny that I have an IMDb account, and I didn't even know that I did, but it's from it's not from any of my big movies, although I have been an extra in some really horrible movies. But it's from my appearances as an academic expert on shows like Gangland and, you know, I mean, the History Channel, and I've been on like a ton of these shows. So there is an account for me, but I don't think that's going to open, you know, I don't think that's going to give me a meeting with Martin Scorsese.
Well,
not that he's my, you know, director that I'm. Yes, we've got plenty of really good directors here in Portland, but, you know, we'll see.
Right.
It's a dream.
Well, you never know. And then last week I had Holly Overton with a new book, but she's already been a TV writer for a while with Cold Case.
Yeah, I saw.
Yeah, you saw her? Yeah, she was fantastic. So, Randy, we got you in place, you know, and you know a great publicist already.
That's true.
An entertainment publicist. So that's good. So, okay, so tell me more then. Tell me more about Mission of the Sacred Heart and the characters. I posted a video of you reading from that book.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Right.
I tell you what. As a publicist, let me tell you, I try to tell people when people call me up or they message me and go, well, I want, you know, I've got a book, okay? And they go, and I want you to get me a book signing. Okay, first of all, what do you want a book signing for? Nobody cares that you wrote a book. What have you done to promote it? What have you done to make people feel that you care about them and you engage them to come? You need to, don't just sit behind a table looking irritable. You know, you need to bring people in. You need to set something up. So, like, for one client, I had a book where it's about a cop that becomes a dope dealer who's much better at that than being a cop, and he has nightclubs and stuff. So I had a club set up, police tape, you know, blue light. Had a friend of mine who was the reigning queen of burlesque in the U.S. at that time come in to read with him. Yeah, you got to create some kind of atmosphere. And yours
is
perfect because you're in there, you're reading, and there's a part in the book about the, and I've watched this a few times, the singing of the song down in the basement, and you've got people sitting there singing. I mean, it's just so... I thought, this is it.
Well, yeah, I want it to be a little bit different. I have a reading. It's funny that you mentioned that because I have a reading on Saturday for the new book at a record store here in Portland, a great record store called Music Millennium. And, you know, it's just sort of fitting that the rock novel would be in a record store. And I have this singer, Luz Elena, who's the singer of this amazing band, Ila Bamba, is going to perform a few songs. And so, you know, I'm trying to make it sort of an event that people would want to come out on a Saturday to hear a guy read from his book. So yeah, that one, you know, that scene is, I love that scene because so a lot of this book has to do with like my generation. And one of the parts of my generation, I'm always trying to explain to younger people, you know, what was life was like in the 20th century was before the internet, what latchkey kids had was the 4 o'clock movie. And that I, you know, got home from school and was glued to the TV, especially if it was raining on the 4 o'clock movie. And there would be themes. There would be like a Japanese monster week or, you know, Western week. And I loved the musical weeks, whether it was Elvis movies or West Side Story and the whole notion of people just bursting into song and it becoming a musical number. So I wanted to write that into the book. And so there is a scene where they're in this bar basement. And the guy who's the rock singer and his opera singer are having a conversation about, you know, is it easy or hard to sing rock and roll? I mean, obviously opera is difficult. So they put the song on the jukebox in the basement. This great Etta James song, and it turns into this musical number, and everybody just sort of bursts into dance and is singing along with it. And all of a sudden, it's like the whole basement bar has been transformed into like a Frankie and Annette movie. And so I like doing that. There's a scene like that in the new book where there's a dance number, a bunch of Nazi skinheads break into a big sort of Michael Jackson dance number.
You know, I liked in that reading too, where you start when you reference the by doing the Anne Margaret with the little Watusi and then the Elvis thing, and then
right.
You stop to explain things like Annette and Frankie, Beach Blanket Bingo, how to stuff a wild bikini.
I know there's some references. I know that I lose. Oh my gosh, my little cozy is working on her Elmo puzzle. There are some. Sorry about that. There are some folks that will miss the references, and that's just I'm writing for sort of me and my people, I guess, who kind of get those references from the four. You know, I wasn't around during the original Frankie and Annette movies, but I certainly saw a lot of them on the 4 o'clock movie.
Well, people say I wasn't around then, talking about any type of event. I go, well, you know, you weren't around during the Bible, and you know about that, or Shakespeare's work.
That's true.
So, go ahead and say again while I'm thinking about it. Go ahead and say where you're going to be this Saturday and what time.
Okay, so I have a reading in Portland, Oregon, Portland, Maine, at Music Millennium, which is this historic record store in Portland, at 6 p.m. With Luz Elena Mendoza from the fabulous band Vila Bamba performing. It would be great, 6 to 7 p.m.
So, all right.
I'm very excited about it. Very excited.
It's date time.
That's it. You go, and then you go have a nice romantic dinner, and then you just go to the – I mean, it's Portland, and it's raining, so basically everybody ends up in the bar drinking, you know, very dark beer, being all maudlin and depressed, and then they go home and write poetry about it. It's a Portland story. I mean, we're like, this town is like one big cliche, but we love our cliche.
I think it was either, I don't know if it was part of Brain Pickings in the New Yorker, someone talking about the Romeo and Juliet story and saying, you know, if he had lived today, Romeo wouldn't have killed himself, but he would have been the most obnoxious slam poet. Batman. I'm sorry. No. That was a different thing. Batman. Said Batman. If he saw his parents die as a kid, he wouldn't grow up to be a crime fighter.
Right.
He would have been the most
Batman,
obnoxious.
Yeah. He's so emo.
In Gotham. Yeah. That's what would have happened to him. Yeah. So there you go. Okay. So we've got an idea on the characters of the
characters, but you know those are the core ones. It's this guy Zach, who's the graduate student, who is depressed because his fiance left him on the altar. That's the thing that's got him going over the edge. And his friend Lenny the rock star. Which I realized when I was writing the new book, and Lenny's in the new book, that I never gave Lenny a last name. I should have a contest or something to figure out what this guy's last name should be if it gets cast as a film role.
Yeah, the engagement. Yeah, people like that.
Yeah.
So.
That's not a bad idea.
These two guys,
we've jumped forward 15 years in the future. Because the reality of the first book is I was really writing it back at the turn of the century in 99. And then I sat on it for a while. And then Cozy really wants this Elmo puzzle done, man.
She's so focused. I envy her.
She is. The ebook thing took off, and kind of the self. I mean, the publishing industry sort of went the way of the music industry, where it became all about doing it yourself and putting your own music out and using the internet. And it's like the dog eat dog world of publishing, of you know, dragging your manuscript around, you know, Manhattan and begging for an agent to take it to somebody else to look at. I've sort of gone out the window, and so you just put it out yourself, and so I did, and it did really well. I mean, I'm lucky that I had a good social circle to help launch it, but it didn't really see the light of day until it was published in 2011. So when I went through my next drama, my next blue period, as we might call it, and was again needed to write my way out of it. You know, it was literally 15 years after I started writing the first book. So I picked up with these guys, you know, a bit later in their stories. And so thinking about how their lives would have changed. And so Lenny, who was in a great rock band, it was really fun. One of the great things about writing this book is I got to come up with a lot of names of bands that didn't exist. So and all these punk rock bands, one was called the Mary Tyler War. I thought of that. That's a really great band. Anybody can take it. It's open. So Lenny, the main character, was in a band called GERD. They were kind of a grungy band, but then they changed their name to Sort Of, which I thought was also a good name. But so we follow him into the future, and the band thing didn't work out, and now he's working in publishing. And he's the kind of guy that goes around and found other bands' songs for commercials, which, you know, is kind of like the way, you know, MTV is dead and you don't really have a way of getting your music in front of people unless it ends up in a car commercial. And it sounds so evil. Like the 1990s version of me sees that as greatly evil. But now I recognize it as sort of a necessity of the music business. I have one. Okay, puzzle. I have one little name drop story I'll give you, just to sort of I was on Angie Bowie's radio show. She has a really great radio show, and we've been friends for a long time. And I had a David Bowie story to tell, which was the
I got to get back into this. Did you meet Angie when she was living in Atlanta and you were in Atlanta?
Yeah. She was the first guest in my class when I was teaching at Emory University. She was my first guest lecturer. She came in a pink jumpsuit.
Because I met her there, too. Well, actually, I met her at the lesbian bar. What's it called? The one that was bombed, where my band used to play. But
Right, on Cheshire Bridge.
Cheshire Bridge, yeah.
In Piedmont.
And also... Yeah, Cheshire Bridge in Piedmont. Yeah, I used to play there, and that's where I met her. And for a while, she was married to a friend of mine, a gay hairdresser. But anyway, so yes, that name just keeps coming up time and time again, Angie Bowie. So maybe I'm
going
back. Hey, look, excuse me.
Yeah, she's been very supportive.
What? That's good. I'm sorry. Somebody's coming in the door just a moment.
Oh.
Someone's here.
Hey.
Oh my God, it's Ray D'Africo. Ray, come on in.
Ray!
Hello, Mr. Randy.
Hey, what's up, my brother?
You know, the usual, fighting a good fight and, you know, calling in. I'm getting to be a regular on the show, like this night show, I think.
He's practically a co-host.
You're at least the bumper music.
Yeah, exactly.
I played you last night, Randy. Ray, I played you last night.
Oh, thank you. Cool. Well, yeah, I had to call in because Randy and me go back we were 12 or something, I think. I don't know. Seems like that.
What, does he owe you money?
That'd probably be Paul Lenz, I would imagine.
Yeah.
mutual connection, but no, but we probably saw Cheap Trick a lot together, I would imagine.
Yeah, there were a lot of those shows. You know, so Ray and I are born the same year. We're 1964 babies, same as Michelle Obama. We're all in the same gang. And,
That's right.
You know, that generation of kids, you know, especially when you're 14 in 1978, and concerts are only $8.50 at the most, you're going to all the big shows that come to town. I mean, if you're the kid in your high school that's the music person, you're sort of. It's like a scene from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. You know, you're sort of obligated to go to all these shows and come back the next day with your concert T-shirt to your report.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, Ray was up in Roswell and I was in Stone Mountain, and I think we were sort of both playing that role of the kids that went to all the rock shows and were just, you know, sold our souls to the rock and roll devil at an early age.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of how we all met each other, I think, you know, just going to see Cheap Trick, and we all like the same bands, you know, The Who and all that. I just thought I'd call in. I guess you have the new book with the Dream Police in it. I haven't actually purchased it yet, but I've been meaning to. So,
Well,
did
damn
you
it,
read
I
the
purchased
book?
Your new album, Ray, so come on. Give me
I know I owe. So that you did a reversal right there. That's yeah, I know. I've been preoccupied, you know, doing other things with the latest changes in the environment and, you know.
Yes, I know. I know. Ray has been sort of my political lifeline on Facebook. I just let all my anger go right through Ray.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody is. That's why I'm stressed. It's like, you know, okay. But it's a good place to vent, you know. So,
let me ask you a question, Randy. Another question is that I know we're here to talk about the Dream Police, and that's why you and Cozy are here. But would you mind, because of your work with the Oregon Spotlight and the Hate Crime Research Network, and because we have Ray here, but for God's sake, Ray is fighting the good fight. I mean, he's walking the walk and doing the heavy lifting and everything. So would you mind if we talk about that, about his...
Yeah, let's do that. We'll leave the book to the side for a bit, and let's talk
I don't want to disregard your book.
The state of hate.
No, we could talk about the book and both, but if you want to talk about that now, that's fine, too, you know. I've never been a real political person. It's just a moral thing, you know. It makes you do it, you know. It's like you got to do something. I don't know. At least I do. I feel that way, you know. So I'm doing what I can, you know. I'm just basically connecting people that have the same thoughts, you know. And a lot of people don't, especially in Facebook, and you know, even old friends of ours that. What I can't understand is people we grew up with that, like the Clash and got old, suddenly became the opposite of that. I mean, you can't listen to the Clash and have those political views, in my opinion. But
it's interesting. There is this sort of, you know, I mean, I think it's the folks that really kind of saw themselves as anarchist. And so, I mean, anarchists can be on the left end of the spectrum or the right end of the spectrum. And they kind of went from, you know, anarchy for a better society to anarchy for me, that I hate, you know, all structure and I don't trust any of the media. And it's been shocking to me too, all these, I mean, I sort of wondered, like, I had to do a little bit of genealogy and look at these friends, like, who are these people who are posting all this right-wing stuff? How do I know them? And they all go back to the Metroplex, basically. and you know, they were anarchists. And so in their weird world, that took them from you know, listening to Crass to voting for Donald Trump. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but yeah. So these are our peers.
Yeah, it's weird because even then, the band I was in, the Night Porters, we were sort of political, but we were also really mod and psychedelic and mix this stuff up. But like, we would run into problems with people like that even back then, like skinheads and whatnot, you know. It was just like, you know, whoa, you know, you're not on the same page is what we're saying here. And unfortunately, you know, it still exists. And, you know, I wish people could get along better, but, you know, sometimes it's, you know, they seem to be doing most of the hating part of it, you know. So, but yes, I am pretty actively involved right now and just trying to make people aware of what's going on and some of the scary stuff, you know. Of course, a lot of people don't even believe it. Like, I spent the Thanksgiving with my family, which was, you know, god-awful. So I worship families that are all on the same page politically. I, you know, don't have that. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
I think there were a lot of Thanksgivings like that. I think a lot of Thanksgivings went down like that, where you know, some folks just started drinking early.
Yeah, and we try not to get into it, but it's my brother-in-law, because he's a lot of fun to fight with. He understands the fun part of it, you know. And other people just get ugly about it, and then it's just, you know, that's a whole different thing. So
I have a whole wing of my family in Chattanooga, and I love my family there. And whenever I go to Christmas or Thanksgiving dinner, there's always a point, usually, you know, right before dessert, that my aunt will just out of the blue say, "These people on welfare need to get a job." And then everybody looks at me.
Yeah.
Looks at you.
Randy.
Yeah, and I do my little show, my little lecture.
Yeah, exactly. I think we reached that point in my family too. Of course, we're all Italians, so we argue anyway. So it's just, you know, it's just part of it. You know, it just depends on what you're arguing about. You know, so. But yeah, I just, you know, just trying to put the word out there, and you know, hopefully.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, you guys go back a long way, obviously. As you said, you go back a long way, and a good friend.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hardly see, you know, it's always good to see friendships that last this long. And although, you know, I don't know if you've always been this much of an active political activist, Ray, but I know that.
I haven't. Randy has been much more than me, and he's much more knowledgeable. I'm the kind of person that just, like, wings it, you know, and Since I know a lot of people, I try to get them involved. You know, Randy's actually knows what he's talking about. I just say a bunch of crap, you know, and sometimes it gets me in trouble, you know.
I was lucky when we all came together in the 80s, I was a sociology political science major at Emory University. And I, you know, I was just a kid, but, you know, those were the Reagan days. So if you were a little bit political, you were sort of a lot political. You couldn't kind of pay attention to what was going on. I think we're probably going to be like that all over again, and not be somewhat radicalized. And so I went from a kid from Stone Mountain, Georgia, who when I was 16 thought Ronald Reagan was going to save us to, you know, 2 years later, wearing a Reagan hates me t-shirt and going, you know, to shows at 688 and, you know, wanting to, you know, tear down the system and spray painting anarchy symbols on Midtown and things
like that.
Yeah,
well, that's the thing. It's like, it seems like there's always kids that are out there protesting or whatever, but it seems like because they didn't have Reagan, although they did have Bush, but it was like a whole different kind of thing. I don't know how to explain it.
Bush was the kinder, gentler, remember? He was going to be the kinder, gentler version.
Oh,
I think
right.
It was just Reagan's face. Reagan had just, I mean, it's sort of like Trump. It's just a face that you love to hate. I mean, you just sort of, you know, it was easy to, I was sad when Reagan left office in January of 89, because he was just such a great foil. He was just so symbolic of everything that we all opposed on so many levels, that I was sort of sad to see him go, because it really sort of galvanized the people on the other side.
And also, Randy and I both spent time over in England, and Randy and I Ireland too back then, which at the time was very political, and they didn't, you know, there was a lot of protests going on against Reagan there. I mean, they had Thatcher, so, you know, I think that was another part of it. You know, going over there, at least I did in the early 80s when I was 18 or whatever, I got really influenced by that, you know.
Well, it was very interesting to see, you know, we had the peak of the Cold War, but we were somewhat removed from it, but Europe was on the front line. So I went to a school in London when I was 18 in 82, and all of a sudden I saw where those policies were manifest on these people who were literally, you know, on the front line of World War III and, you know, sort of were fighting for their lives. So I think Ray's right. It's like when you get out of this country, you get sort of a perspective that you don't get when you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you get.
Yeah.
You can get caught in the bubble here, so to speak. I mean, watching CNN over and over like I do.
sort of like Robert Burns, or with some power the gift he gives to see ourselves as others see us, you know. But and it's true, we don't always see how the people did. Just while I've got the mic for a second, I just want to say, if you're listening to Madam Perry Salon Live right now, my guest, author and sociologist, Dr. Randy Blazak, and also my co-host, Ray D'Africo, who, as you know, we've been playing a lot of music from his CD, Solo A Go-Go. You should get it. And, of course, our guest advisor on the show tonight is Cozy Blazak, too.
I think she can say hello. Want to say hi?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
She's all shy now.
Yeah. That's okay. She wants to work behind the scenes. That's just fine. You know, she can do what she wants.
That's right.
So, since you're talking about this with the Reagan, that the the other side. Randy, you said that the story for the Dream Police, it's inspired by it says your departure from Portland State and being forced out when a skinhead inmate targets you.
Right. So this is another part. But while we have the rocking Ray D'Africo on the line, I'd like to ask Ray his take on this. So these two books are both subtitled A Rock Novel. And, and they're inspired by the golden days of listening to albums in their entirety. So I think Ray might be able to identify this. So you get an album, you go in your room, you put on side one, and it's not in the background, it's not streaming, it's not on a playlist. You're just listening to the album as an act in of itself. You're looking at the album cover, you're reading the liner notes, you're reading the lyrics, and you're just existing for 35 minutes inside that album. Side one, side two, the sort of ritual of going through it, which means while you're listening to it, you're thinking about the songs. And this is, pre-MTV, so you don't know what the songs look like. We haven't been told, by wonderful directors what these songs look like. So they're existing in your head, and they are playing these stories out. I still, when I hear Beatles Revolver, it's the way I heard it when I was, 13 years old. So the first book is sort of inspired by an ELO album that I had. And then the second book is obviously Cheap Trick's Dream Police. But I was wondering if Ray, if you kind of have that similar memory of listening to albums experience.
That's pretty much what I did from a young age. I mean, for me, it would start with the Partridge Family. I go way back with that. I had my fake Partridge Family band,
I have to tell you my version of that. I want you to complete this thought, but my version of that was I would put on an Osmond Brothers album on my parents' stereo in the living room, go into my bedroom, pretend that the Osmond Brothers were practicing in the other room, and I was the Osmond that nobody talked about, Randy Osmond.
That is too cool. And it's not too late to actually join their band. I don't know. That is way cool. I didn't have a name like that. I just assumed I was David Cassidy, but I don't know. I'm glad other people were doing it, though. Otherwise, it would feel really, really odd. But back to your question, I used to I spent most of my time, I was a misfit, and we moved a lot, so I didn't have friends, and what I had was records. When I found records, it was all over for me. I would literally have headphones, and I had my lava light, and I would do the same thing, and my family was really worried about me. It's like that I wouldn't leave my room, and, I didn't care, and that's all I did, and I got a lot of musical knowledge from it. I was listening to pretty obscure stuff for my age. I mean, it's like going back and listening to Quadrophenia. I mean, even if it was the soundtrack one, I heard the soundtrack one before the actual Quadrophenia record, because it came out in 79 and we were like 15 or something. So, that's basically what inspired me to write songs.
And there was also
this
kind of notion of scarcity. Like, you can get any music in the world pretty much, on Spotify or YouTube. I mean, you can find anything that you want. If you lived outside of, Manhattan or L.A., finding records was a hard thing to do. I mean, I bought records at JCPenney's, and they didn't have the cool records. I mean, when I found the Columbia House Record Club, that was like a lifesaver that you get 12 records for a penny, and then maybe you have to pay some money later. I didn't really worry about that part. But, when you actually got your hands, like, I knew what punk rock looked like from reading Cream magazine and Hip Parader magazine before I ever heard it. I knew what the Ramones looked like long before
I could ever find a way
to actually hear them. So when you got these records, it was like a very sort of ritualistic, sacred thing. Like, I got this Clash record. And, people would go over to each other's houses and listen to albums. I remember a friend who had like a Cheech and Chong album. Like, oh my God, he's got a Cheech and Chong album. Let's go over and listen to it. I mean, it was such the scarcity drove this incredible value of getting your hands on these records. I think about, like teenage Paul McCartney and John Lennon talking about, getting the records off the ships in Liverpool and how, like,
right.
they would just flock to them. Like, what? Oh, my God, there's a chord there I've never heard. Or is this a black guy or a white guy? I mean, it was such a thing that, I mean, it's great that everything in the world is available now. And, you know, we touch our phone and we've got whatever. But it was this just kind of a religious experience of getting this record. Like, oh, the first time I actually was in a room with a copy of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon was a total transformative experience. I was like, what the hell is this? This is, you know, there's the Partridge Family, and then there's this.
You know what?
Quickly evolve. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me, guys. That's the thing people – that's the thrill that we had that people don't have today. Like, you're right. That was going together. Like, I got them at Sears. I got my 45s at the Beals at Sears. And it's at Kmart on Gresham Road, and you had to go and you'd look, Music Grotto in South DeKalb Mall, I'd look and I'd find, you know, Traffic or everything with to do with Todd Rundgren. I had to, you know, you'd listen to the whole thing. Mine were the first albums by Yes, first ELP, you know, that was just my sanctuary.
I would buy the record, I would find out the day the record came out, and I would be at Turtles. The day it came in on a Tuesday, I got their shipments at 2:00. I'd be there so I could say I got the first one out of the box. And I worked at Turtles for 7 years, and
that's
I'll never
right.
forget
yeah.
the morning that Michael Jackson's Thriller came out, and the line of people there to get it the day that it came out.
Wow!
You know, to have that communal experience of like I was there, I got the record the morning it came out.
Yeah, these kids know nothing about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That thrill, that excitement around it. They don't have that, you know. Ray, would you mind opening up the beaded curtain? We have another guest coming into the studio, into the Madame Perry Salon.
Oh, yeah.
Hi,
here we go.
Welcome to Madame
Hello.
Perry Salon. Hi.
How you doing?
Doing great. Is this Vince?
Yes, this is Vince, and I have about 3% on my phone.
Oh, okay. All right, this is Vincent Levy Bryant. He is a he's a musician, and he is working on a film right now. And, Ray, you know Ray D'Africo. I hope you know Ray and Randy Blazak in here. So come on in and sit down.
No, I don't recognize the name, but what you're talking about, Ray, is so real, an experience that is not.
Oh, yeah.
They don't have that anymore. These kids don't. Everything is download, move fast. It's on your phone. You share it, this and that, you know, which is great. It's their generation of how they do media. But, yeah, I remember those days of saving your little pennies up to get that 45 each week, you know.
Well, like Randy said,
going
to your friends to listen to music. You know, that was the thing you'd do. You go see somebody. Let's go listen to them. I got this. What have you got? I've got, you know, and they say what records they had. And you go in there and sit down and listen.
Yeah, I can remember going to my neighbors to listen to Hot August Night by Neil Diamond. And here is Terry Cherry.
Wow.
And, you know, it was like, it was a cool song. I didn't, you know, it was like, it's just so weird saying that now, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, but at the time, you know, it was like, wow, this is cool. You know, anything was cool.
We had
bored.
One kid in our neighborhood. One kid in our neighborhood named Mike, who was the only kid who had Frampton Comes Alive, and we listened to all four sides of it. And Do You Feel Like We Do, when he's doing the voice box.
Oh, yeah.
And he had us convinced that Peter Frampton was such a great guitarist that he could make his guitar talk. Because we didn't know anything, you know, had no video, we had no idea of knowing what he was doing. He was just so good, and we play that over and over at Mike's house, like, man, he's so good, he can make it, do you fail, how does he do that?
Yep. Peter Frampton,
exactly.
He did it first, and then Roger Troutman with Zapp, he did his funk version of it. It was awesome, that voice box, that talk box thing.
Oh, and
awesome.
Joe Perry, too, he used it on Sweet Emotion and all that stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Wow.
Yeah, Aerosmith, Awesome. I'm sorry if I blank out, my phone is just going to die, but I had to get in tonight to hear and talk to you guys and tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing. It's awesome, man. Just awesome.
I'm so glad you did. I'm so glad you dropped in.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Vince has a pretty heavy provenance himself in music, so I figured you'd enjoy this very much with Randy Blazak and Ray D'Africo, my buddy Vince. Am I the luckiest girl in the world or what?
You are you got magic, girl. That's all I gotta say. You got magic for sure.
I luckiest girl in the world.
Yep.
So, all right. So where were we, Professor Blazek?
I guess I should talk a little bit about the new book and the Dream Police. Ray might remember that Cheap Trick on that tour were supposed to play at the Omni, and they didn't sell enough tickets, so they had to move it to the Fox Theater. But it was called
Ray's
show. There.
Yeah,
me too.
Wow.
All right. All right, we have this like parallel history. So
everyone
Dream
was
Police
there.
Was an, yeah, right. I know.
Yeah.
I know. It's one of those shows. So the Dream Police was another album. It came out in '79, and I spent a lot of time in my room listening to it and sort of imagining the songs all sort of fitting together, telling the story. The first one that was the ELO album was kind of easy because I always thought it was a rock opera for most of my life. And then when it came out on CD, I listened to it in my 30s and thought, it's just a bunch of songs, not a rock opera. My teenage brain sort of put them together like it was a rock opera. But so the Dream Police is a little bit more, you know, the more sort of songs and it hangs together less well. But I was in another position to write a story, and so I wanted to use that as the next album, because I could do this all day long with all these albums that, you know, I thought were concept albums when I was a teenager. And so this one, the themes around this one are this idea of lucid dreaming, that there is this whole thing where people practice this thing where you are awake in your dream and you can control your dream. And, you know, the first thing that people want to do when they can do that is fly. But the next thing that you want to do, if you have the ability to control your dreams, is go see the Beatles at the Cavern, or go see Led Zeppelin at the LA Forum, or go see the Velvet Underground at Max's Kansas City, all of which happen in this book. And so these two main guys from the first book get into this idea of lucid dreaming, mainly because their lives are so messed up and they're trying to figure out, can I go back and fix something? But they keep taking these detours into these rock scenes because they just, you know, they just want to go. I want to see the Beatles play at the Cavern, you know, so I can have this experience where I go and do it. So, that's part of it. It also takes place in Portland. Portland, people might not know, has been named the most gentrified city in America. I mean, there's this huge transformation that happens in neighborhoods. I live in a neighborhood called the Alberta Arts District that when I moved into it was called the Hood. But it is now, you know, they renamed it, right, for good marketing. You know, the crack house is now a sushi bar. And I'm looking at the house across the street from me that when I moved in here was a real brothel with a pimp and everything. And it's now a nice little couple with their little kids that live there. So the gentrification thing is also kind of dreamlike. You know, I live in a town where you may go by a corner 1,000 times, and all of a sudden the house on that corner is just gone. You know, they're going to tear it down and build a little like mini McMansion or something. And you have this weird experience because the house is gone. You didn't see them tear it down, and you can't remember what house was there. All of a sudden it's like, you know, I've been by the spot 1,000 times. What did that house look like? Or you
That's
go downtown.
Atlanta now too. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Atlanta's the same. And when I go back to Atlanta, I can't find my way around because I used to turn left at the bank, and the bank is now a crack house or a sushi bar.
Right.
So you know, it's something completely different. So there is that dreamlike quality that anybody that is living in a gentrifying place experiences. So I kind of work that in, and then also my work, you know, my work on Skinheads goes all the way back. Even before the Night Porter days, when I hopped on a train in London in 1982 in Victoria Station, and there was these skinheads writing swastikas on the car wall and markers. And I had this thought that, like, oh, yeah, you know, young people are all radical and left-wing. And then I saw they were writing swastikas, and I was in my little Italian suit, and then they wrote, "Kill a mod." And I'm like, oh, I need to get out of this train car. So, yeah, and then in 1984, the Atlanta skinhead stole my Vespa scooter and set it on fire. 85, and so I've been like, you know, I've been on the skinhead thing for a long time, and so that's one of the things that I'm sort of known for, but which is a weird thing to say. So one of the characters in this is a guy who's mixed up with a racist prison gang, which is a very big problem in this country, especially out on the West Coast, so that plays into it. And then the overarching thing that kind of pulls it together is the sort of sexual politics of higher education and you know, the people who are the professors who are kind of lined up against the administrators of the university and the union politics and all that, which all that gets kind of complex. I need like a really quick little elevator speech. If I am in an elevator with Martin Scorsese, he's like, all right, kid, you got 3 seconds. What's your book about? I'm like, well, it's about the sexual politics of higher education, gentrification, and racist prison gangs.
That sounds good. He's like, I can work with that.
I can work with that. Well, but I'm really proud of it. I mean, it turned out really well. And also, I've been spending a lot of time in Mexico over the last 4 years. My wife is Mexican, and I think I've been infused with this notion of magical realism and kind of, you know, living in a little bit of a dream world. So the book takes place in the real world and the dream world at the same time. So there's a little bit of, you know, people might be confused while they're reading it. Is this real? Is this really happening, or is this a dream? And then, you know, hopefully by the end you figure it all out. So that's my highly caffeinated description of it.
And speaking of your wife, who is obviously as talented as she is beautiful, she's a painter. She did the cover of the book, didn't she?
Yeah, she did.
Andrea?
She does amazing work. Andrea Barrios, a really talented painter. And I just begged her to do something for the cover, and something that would also be a little bit of a link to the Cheap Trick album cover. So the window on the cover of the book is from the album cover. So that's the little connection. Super talented. I'm really lucky to be in a house full of amazing work that she's done. She's working on a project right now to raise money for the children in Aleppo in Syria that she's going to be launching on Saturday.
I will put a link to her website, Andrea Barrios Art.
Okay, great.
On the Madame
Perry
Salon page.
And also, I should say that 10% of the book sales for the Dream Piece are also going to UNICEF Aleppo Relief. I mean, we're, as parents, we're just so heartbroken seeing what's coming across from the news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty horrible.
Yeah.
No, there's a lot of bad stuff going on right now. But I'm not going to get into that. I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay, an interesting thing, too, because, yeah, I definitely wanted to get in that about Andre Barrios doing the artwork and the 10% of the book sales going to UNICEF for Syrian relief. I wanted to make sure that we did talk about that on the air. But also, and she's working on the other thing, a series of butterfly paintings for the same to benefit them as well. But says that writing The Dream Police, that you almost all the dreams in the book were had by real people. I crowdsourced dreams from friends while I was writing it. Most are mine and Andre's. Now, did you crowdsource dreams from Ray D'Africo? Because, you know, I'm sure he's got quite a...
I should.
That would be nightmares.
I bet there's a scene in the book that takes place in Max's Kansas City that I think you'll appreciate. What I was doing is, I mean, I was trying to practice this lucid dreaming thing, and so we were really heavily into our dreams. But I would be writing and sitting at the coffee shop and be a part of the book where I thought, this is a good part for a dream. And I would just go on Facebook and I'd say, hey, has anybody had any weird dreams lately? And then all these people, you know, would say, oh, this. And I'm like, thanks. All right, stop. I got it. So I have a friend, Kira, who Ray knows, who talked about having a dream that she was on a plane with Cher, and Cher was, like, complaining about her dogs or something on her phone. So I'm like, oh, man, this is perfect. So
that probably really happened, though. That might not have been a dream. But I'm just guessing. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, recently I had a guest on here, Louise Monero, who's the world expert on out-of-body experiences. So maybe it wasn't really a dream at all. Maybe she, you know, visited. Like I said, when I promoted the show, I said, can't afford a vacation? Tired of having a staycation? Listen to this show and learn how to go out of body. But anyway, that's another thing. You know, I had a dream about Paul Weller, and I remember one morning I woke up and told a couple of girlfriends about it, and their reactions were totally different. And so it makes me want to ask a few different people for their reaction to that dream so that I can put it in as one chapter of the book that I'm about to publish, Memoirs of a Misanthrope. And so if you guys don't mind, later on I'll send that to you.
Well, you know, the thing about lucid dreaming that's so exciting, it's not an easy thing to do, but you have to kind of become obsessed with your dreams. You keep a dream journal. You talk about your dreams a lot to other people, and you just and while you're awake, you kind of ask yourself, is this a dream or am I in the real world? And the idea is that you start doing that when you're dreaming also. And so you just become like dream crazy. And so it takes a lot of work. At least it did for me. But it's really fun because usually, you know, you don't want to hear people's dreams. There's that great line in Paul Bowles, Sheltering Sky, was like, there's nothing more boring than hearing people talk about their dreams. Like, you know, so what am I supposed to do with this? You had a dream that your teeth were falling out. Great. Thanks very much. So, but when you're kind of really engaged in this act, this sort of practice, then it's really fun to kind of talk to people about their dreams and try to figure out what the connections are.
And that must have been exciting. Well, you know, I wish you the much success with Dream Police and Mission of the Sacred Heart. And now, you say your wife, Andrea, is Mexican. Do you speak Spanish as well? You do speak Spanish. I know I've seen you.
Un poquito. Cozy is better than, a little bit better than I am. Cozy, can you say hola? No, she just said queso.
Hola,
that's
Cozy.
What she wants. You want queso?
Okay. No,
she's like, I'm not going on that show unless I'm getting paid.
I've seen video of you trying to interview her, and she was more like that. I can't remember who was the guest.
Yeah, she's like that. When there's not a mic in front of her or telephone or – okay, do you want some queso? Queso. Okay, so we spent our summers living on this island in Mexico called Isla Mujeres, and there's a guy who walks down the street, and he just says, queso, Oaxaca, and he's selling these big blocks of cheese. So that's her favorite Spanish is queso. Queso, Oaxaca.
Well, as I said, I wish you much success. And also, I'm so glad. You know, I'm so glad that you came on here. I've been wanting to ask you for a long time, and you're always so busy and traveling.
Well, I are like brothers because, you know, we grew up separately, and then we didn't find each other until we were about 18 years old, and then we've been connected ever since.
He's a wonderful guy. He really is. I think very highly of Ray. And glad he's your friend and mine. And proud of him and the work he does and the work that you do as well. So I've got links, everybody, to Randy Blazak, all of his work, his blog, Watching the Wheels, Dad. Great blog to follow. That's what I first started reading was Watching the Wheels, Dad, getting to know more about your work. And also I'll have links to everything you do, your blog, also to Andrea Barrios, your wife's website, so people can see her gorgeous art. And remember, too, that 10% of the book sales for the Dream Police go to UNICEF Syrian Relief. Randy Blazak,
yeah,
thank
very
you
important.
So much for being on that. Yes,
it's been
it
a great pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
See, it wasn't scary at all. Thank you. Will you come back sometime?
Yeah, of course. I'd love to.
Yeah. Well, you've been here before. You know the way to get here. Cozy, so glad that you were with us. And wish you the best. You have a parting line for everybody. You know what I think I should do? I think I should close out with a Ray song.
Yes, please.
I think I will. So you see, everything's going to be all right. I played that last night. Gun Lovers, Something in the Night.
Your choice.
Something. I think I'd do Gun Lovers because he's got a specific thing in mind. So if you have a parting line for the listeners tonight.
Well, I think people should just, you know, have really good dreams and try to connect their dreams to the people around them, and we'll be all right. We'll make it through all this.
All right. I like that. That's the best. I couldn't have said it better. All right. Thanks so much, Randy. Dr. Randy Blazak here on Madame Perry Salon. And don't forget, coming up soon, we're going to have Shelley Bloom. We've got Rudy Sarzo from Quiet Riot and Whitesnake and Harvey. You know Harvey J.K., don't you?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, Harvey J.K. is going to be here in a couple of weeks.
All right on.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he agreed to it until he found out that you were going to be on. So then he figured I was okay. So that's pretty good, too. That's a good testimony. All right, and we're going to – so thank you. Go get The Dream Police and The Mission of the Sacred Heart by Dr. Randy Blazak, and then also by Solo Agogo by our friend –
Come love us and be what they believe. Living in their own reality.